If you are currently sitting in one of the back five rows, you have to either leave or move forward. That is not a joke, but that just was. So move forward. Jamie and Julie, move forward.
Does anybody else need a handout?
They're just trying to be cool.
No, I thought if I sat anywhere else, Bob would have gone. So
the reason why I wanted you to move forward, unless you have a very little kid and you need to hide in the back or something, I'm totally with that, is because I tend to, when I talk about some of the things I'm going to talk about, whisper. I have a very loud voice, but some things are worth whispering about. And if you are particularly hard of hearing, this is going to be your fault if you can't hear and you're sitting in the back. So Brett very kindly and Cindy introduced my topic. Now, what did Brett talk about? Yes, this is a quiz. You should raise your hand. Yes, innocence. Innocence. He talked about innocence this morning, yesterday, Vastation. Innocence. And what was the definition of innocence he gave from heaven and hell?
Willingness
to be led by the Lord. So there's external innocence and internal innocence. External innocence is a willingness to be led by your parents or anybody. This, by the way, is why children are particularly susceptible to all kinds of evil, because they're willing to be led by all sorts of things. It's also why a lot of people who try to recapture their youth end up in evils of every kind, because they too are willing to be led by all sorts of dumb things, like Ferraris, or who knows what. Internal innocence, oh, I know, knocking on the Ferrari. Internal innocence is a willingness to be led by the Lord. That's a key part. Now, I said that Brett helped cue up my talk, and I also suggested that Cindy did. What did Cindy do for us? Peace! Yes, she played wonderful music, as she always does, but particularly today, she sang a song about peace. Now, before we get to our readings, there's something you should know a little bit about the way the universe and your mind works with emotions. Some of you have probably heard this talk from me before. If you haven't, well, yeah, this will be fun. If you have, it's worth reviewing over and over again because people forget. All right? So you have a will and an understanding, right? Okay, you know that. You have what generates emotions and what generates thoughts, your will and your understanding. But how does that work? Well, the way it works is you have affections. Affection is a willingness to change on behalf of something. All right? That's an affection. That's one part. And then the second part is the capacity to feel because of that thing. So for instance, if I have, and I'm going to use my classic example, a cookie, an affection for a cookie, then I am willing to change for cookies. I'm willing to give my money away. I'm willing to give my time away. I'm willing to go out of my way. I'm willing to make space for cookies. Not only that, to quote my nephew, when asked if he was full, he said yes. He ran off. Then he came back and wanted a cookie. He said, "You're full." And he said, "I have a cookie-shaped hole." If you have an affection for cookie, you have a cookie-shaped hole. And when that cookie-shaped hole is plugged with a cookie, you experience delight. If someone takes your cookie away, you experience fear, anger, and sadness. So an affection for something is what generates those emotions. Note, however, an affection is not an emotion. You are not your emotions. Your emotions are how you experience your affection. An emotion is the experience of an affection. The experience of an affection. You are not your hate or your anger or even your joy. And you are not peace. You are not your emotions. You are your affections. fact, you are so much your affections that your thoughts spring forth from them, unknowingly. And we're taught, to go back a little bit to Matthew and, well, Matthew's talk especially, if you want to have an idea of what your loves are, first you must examine your affections. But you cannot know what your affections are except by examining your delights. So examine what brings you delight, and that will tell you what you have an affection for. The reason why this is so important is because what makes heaven so awesome? What being an angel is so wonderful? The reason why being an angel is so wonderful is because they have an affection, which is titled innocence. And from that affection, they experience an emotion called peace. And that peace is all-encompassing, which we'll see in the reading. So, affection, innocence, emotion, peace. They are not peace. They are innocence. All right? So let's go into our readings. You have two handouts here. They're not labeled one or two. The first one, the one that is I call the first one, is why you really, really, really want to be an angel. But that's not professional, so it's only one really. The second one is the angelic life on earth is not easy. Bom, bom, bom. It's not easy. The angelic life on earth. So we're going to deal a little bit first with heaven and hell. So this is passages from heaven and hell about innocence and peace. I've edited them for formatting and studying. But other than that, I've stuck to a specific translation. Somebody might be able to figure out which. The rest of you can just enjoy. All right, so the innocence of childhood. The innocence of childhood, or of children, is not genuine innocence. For it is innocence not an internal form, but only an external. Nevertheless, one may learn from it what innocence is. Well, that's handy. We're looking at kids, we can learn what innocence is. Since it shines forth from the face of children, and from some of their movements, and from their first speech, and affects those about them. It can be seen that children have no internal thought, for they do not yet know what is good and what is evil, or what is true and what is false, of which such thought consists. So you can see it in little kids. You can see just their willingness to be led by the parents, because they don't know good from evil. So they're just willing to be led. It's usually a wonderful, beautiful thing. You can just see it in kids. Now, the innocence of wisdom is genuine innocence. When you attain wisdom, wisdom is the capacity to apply truth to life. Wisdom is when you can take truth and use it in your life. That's what wisdom is. So once you start gathering all these truths and actually try to live them, now you start having wisdom. Those who are in a state of innocence, and here are some great, great qualities of innocent people. They attribute nothing of good to themselves. No hewers of wood or grass. They don't take merit. But regard all things as received and ascribe them to the Lord. They think, oh, this cookie, it's the Lord's cookie. They really do think that. You can see that in children sometimes too. They wish to be led by him and not by themselves. They love everything that is good and find delight in everything that is true. Because they know and perceive, this is key, that loving what is good, that is willing and doing it, is loving the Lord, and loving truth is loving the neighbor. Some other day I'll give a talk about how loving the truth is loving the neighbor, but I recommend just reflecting on that sometime on your own. How do you love the neighbor? By loving truth. It's a profound thought. They live contented with their own, whether it be little or much, because they know they receive just as much as is good for them, those receiving little for whom a little is useful, and those receiving much for whom much is useful. If you notice, these definitions or these qualities are sounding less and less like children. That doesn't sound like kids, certainly not 10-year-olds. They do not themselves know what is good for them. The Lord alone knowing this, who looks in all things that he provides to what is eternal? Now, this is tricky. Angels acknowledge that they don't know what's best for them. Only the Lord does. Think about that in your own life. How much do you, trying to follow the Lord, slip into thinking that you do know what's best for you? Because, hey, you've read the Word. You know what's best for you. It's a profound thought to genuinely acknowledge that you don't know what's best for you. They are not anxious about the future. Anxiety they define as grief on account of losing or not receiving things that are not necessary for the uses of life. They never act with cunning from an evil end or with companions, but from what is good, just, and sincere. Cunning is the opposite or the antithesis of innocence. Innocence attributes nothing of good to itself, ascribes all good to the Lord, loves to be led by the Lord, and is, this is the key, the source of the reception of all good and truth. All good and truth. So if you have ever received any good or any truth, it's because of innocence. It's a big thought. All good and truth. All the delights of marriage, all the delights of eating, all the delights that you get from looking at little children, all the delights that you get from singing songs, all the good stuff in life, all the things you know, all the things in your head, all the truths you've gathered up, all of it comes because of innocence. All of the good and truth. So 284. Man is unable, and here's a warning, because this is going to be rough. We talked about how innocence is all this wonderful thing, and how do you experience innocence? When you experience innocence, it's felt as peace. So the experience of innocence is felt as peace. And here's a warning. Man or woman, people on earth, is unable, as long as he is in the body, to receive the peace of heaven. Sorry. Thus, he can have no perception of it. Uh-oh. Why are we having this conversation? Because his perception is confined to what is natural. To perceive it, he must, in respect to thought, be raised up and withdrawn from the body and kept in the spirit, and at the same time be with angels. So you know that's not happening today. That happened to Emanuel Swedenborg. That's why he's able to ascribe peace to us. Don't worry, there's a good part about this later. But you're not going to experience heavenly peace. Yeah.
When we read about people who've had near-death experiences, would they have experienced the peace of heaven?
Perhaps, but the heavenly doctrine doesn't talk about near-death experiences, and so I remain agnostic.
But when you read about here, it says being withdrawn from the body and stuff, they have been through that.
I know, but again, as a minister, because I haven't read anything in the heavenly doctrine that teaches me about that, I remain agnostic. Corner me when I'm not standing in front of a large audience.
Just going back up to 278.
Yes.
Sort of the middle one, the one that said they live contented with their own, whether it be little or much, because they know that they receive, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I've always had problems with statements like this because so many people throughout history have lived in really bad circumstances that, you know, that not just that they've sort of naturally been in a place that doesn't have a lot of food or stuff like that, but they've been oppressed or you know, I mean, there's just so many ways that has happened. And yet, I mean, some people, I guess, might be content with that, but I think a lot of people just feel oppressed. And some people who are more energetic would try to fight out of it or whatever. So it just sort of, I mean, so with the few people who say, oh, it's okay, I'm at Auschwitz right now, it's all right, are they the only ones that are innocent, or, I mean, how's that all work?
We're about to get to that. I'm not dodging your question, but the future passages that I've got printed out here talk about that.
All right.
Because what you're asking is, so how come people all throughout history, sometimes they're nice people, don't experience peace, even if they're willing to be led by the Lord? There they sit in Auschwitz, and they say, I'm at peace with this. Are they really? What is that? And we just read, people on earth do not experience genuine heavenly peace. We're going to read more about peace and the experience of innocence on earth in the next passages.
So then in 278, we're really talking about people in the other world?
That's describing angels. Those are angels.
Well, I'm willing to suspend my disbelief until you explain all truth here, but I'm still confused.
Good. We're going to read the rest of about peace, because peace is going to describe what it's like on earth in a bit, and not until 288. You can read ahead. There are two inmost things of heaven, namely innocence and peace. Then you flip the page. These are said to be inmost things because they proceed directly from the Lord. From innocence comes every good of heaven, and from peace every delight of good. Every good has its delight, and both good and delight spring from love. And whatever is loved is called good, and is also perceived as delightful. Which means if you happen to love evil things, you call them good, and you perceive them as delightful. That's a negative side effect. But that gets back to the peace being the delight of innocence. Peace in the heavens is the divine, inmostly affecting with blessedness, which is another way of saying happiness, everything good therefrom, and from this is every joy of heaven. Also, that it is in its essence the divine joy of the Lord's divine love. In other words, they're feeling the Lord's feeling of joy, resulting from his conjunction with heaven and with everyone, every individual angel there. This joy felt by the Lord. So this is something, a feeling the Lord experiences, pretty neat, in angels and by angels from the Lord is peace, his feeling is. By derivation from this, the angels have everything that is blessed, delightful, and happy, or that which is called heavenly joy. That innocence and peace go together like good and its delight can be seen in little children, who are in peace because they are in innocence, and because they are in peace, are in their whole nature full of play. So remember, this is titled, Why You Really Want to Be an Angel? This is why. Angels are always full of play. They feel the Lord's joy. They really feel it all the time. They wake up in the morning and they can feel the Lord's joy. Now, what does that mean, to feel the Lord's joy? We're going to pause in the middle of 288 for just a moment and get back to our cookie. All right? Now, do people know that there are different degrees of the mind? You've heard that? And the lowest degree is the sensory level of the mind, or the sensual, sometimes described. The sensory level are your senses, like taste, touch, things like that. Let's think about that cookie. Obviously, there is sensual delight in a cookie. I hope you enjoy cookies. I do. You taste it, and it, cookie, right? Taste. Now, the next level, the middle part of the mind, the natural mind, one aspect of describing it is imaginary. How many people here can taste a cookie right now? Oh, yeah. You have a cookie-shaped hole in your mind. And by talking about cookies, 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 you can taste a cookie, and you're kind of getting a, come on, Pierce, or Mr. Frazier, where's the cookie?
Cookies are on the menu this morning.
There are the cookies. All right, don't want to stay seated. But the middle part of your mind is keyed into cookies, and you can actually experience delight associated with that aspect of your mind. Because remember, your mind is also your will. It's not just your understanding. It's also the things that generate feelings, your affections. Now, the higher one is your rational part of your natural mind. Your rational mind is the part of your mind that can compare different things, can learn about things, learn about how things work, And that itself can even be divided into lower and higher levels. So for instance, if you really understand what goes into a cookie, you can enjoy it more. If you study basic economics and understand how global a chocolate chip cookie is, it's an amazing thing. This is a global product. This is a product of at least the 20th century. This is not an 18th century thing, these cookies, especially chocolate chip cookies. This is the chocolate belt. And if you understand the chemistry that goes into it, if you understand all this stuff that goes into making cookies, and then you begin to think about all the things that the Lord has engineered in the universe to bring cookies to us, just the people, the science, the technology, all the amazing things that go into cookies, you can study cookies. And it's just cookies. But pause for a moment before we get into the spiritual and substitute in your mind things that actually matter, like the delights of marriage, or the delights of children, or the delight of reading the word, the delight of useful service. You've experienced the sensual level, experienced the imaginary level as you imagine it now, and then you can really study it. And the higher part of your rational mind is studying it from the word, seeing how the word can lead you to these things. And the word does talk about cookies, because the word talks about everything, but especially talks about useful service, children, marriage, things like that. So let's go into the spiritual. The spiritual is, as we read just recently, the love of truth and thereby the neighbor. Now, when you eat a cookie, it's a natural experience because it's selfish. So how do you spiritually have a love for a cookie? We have to love the neighbor. So go back to my little nephew who wants the cookie. He's got a cookie-shaped hole. I give him a cookie. I am now in the spiritual experience of an affection for cookie. So I am loving the neighbor. Now, hopefully I'm actually genuinely loving him, not just giving him what he wants. Hopefully I'm able to teach him something about positive relationships with parents and with elders, and saying please and thank you and those kinds of things. That I'm genuinely feeding a good thing about him and not just giving him something that's going to make him sick because he's eating too many cookies. But genuinely loving him. I can experience his joy as joy in my own. That is loving. When you give someone those delights, you experience that love. That's spiritual. Now, it's common for people who grew up in the general church to say, well, I just want to go to the natural heaven. I don't think I could ever be a celestial angel. Perish the thought. Aim for the top, okay? You can at least be spiritual. You can at least experience the joy of another as joy in oneself. Natural angels are basically just obedient. They're good, but why do they, if you ask a natural angel, so why do you do good? I'm supposed to. And I like it. That's a natural angel. You ask a spiritual angel, so why do you do good? And they say, look at all the people. When I do good, they're happy. That's a spiritual angel. They experience the joy of another as joy in oneself, even when giving a cookie. So how do you make it celestial? This is what makes heaven heaven. They are filled with the joy of the Lord. Every day, they feel the Lord's joy as their own. And the Lord feels their joy as his own. Go back to me and my nephew. Now, I'm about 36. About. And my nephew, you know, imagine 10, maybe 8. And how are we supposed to approach the Lord? What did Brett say? Or what did Brett read? Because what did the Lord say? How should we approach the Lord? As? So you know that means under 10. So, has anyone ever heard the fun little teaching about how the Lord looks at angels through their foreheads? Ever heard that? Okay, you've heard that. Well, just so you know, the Lord looks at angels through their foreheads. What? That doesn't... No, it's beautiful teaching. Can I have a volunteer? All right, Tom. This is great. John. John.
I can be Tom.
John. John is my uncle. I am a little 10-year-old? How am I looking at him as my father or as my uncle? I'm not. But if I were 10, what part is he looking at?
Forehead.
And how am I approaching him as a little child? Have a seat. How should we approach the Lord? On our knees, as a little child, in innocence and in worship. And as a little child, the Lord is our Father. How old was the Lord when he was on earth?
33.
Yeah. 30 to 33 when he was preaching and leading. And when he says, I am your father, what kind of kids does a 33-year-old have? About 10-year-olds. That's our Heavenly Father. Our Heavenly Father isn't grandpa. Our Heavenly Father is dad. We experience his joy as joy in ourselves. How? Well, when I give my nephew a cookie, and excuse my emotion, when I give my nephew a cookie, how can I experience the Lord's love? Well, if I genuinely have an affection for cookies in a heavenly way, I know all the economics that go into it. I think about cookies. I have an imagination for cookies. I actually genuinely like eating them. They're tasty. I can imagine what it tastes like to him. I can see the joy that he has. But if I am careful and I acknowledge what's going on, I know that this exchange is from the Lord. I can see the Lord in his joy. And I know that by giving him a cookie in this genuine exchange, that I am giving the Lord joy. So you ask a celestial angel, why do you do good? They say, the Lord. So let's read on. 288. Because this moment is going to vanish. We're about to read why. Heavenly, this is in the middle of 288. Heavenly or angelic peace is also possible in men who are in wisdom from the conjunction of good and truth, and who, in consequence, have a sense of content in God. So it is possible to have this kind of innocence and peace. Nevertheless, while they live in the world, this peace lies hidden in their interiors. But it is revealed when they leave the body and enter heaven, for their interiors are then opened. The angel said, oh wait, we'll get to that in a second. So this experience that I have, that, it may be just me tricking myself into feeling this way, but who knows? There's a lot of psychology going into this. But you can have an inkling for what celestial delight is and for what true heavenly peace is from genuinely being willing led to be by the Lord for a moment. But it's going to go away. You're going to leave this building and it'll be gone again. And you'll try again and again and again, and you can't capture that emotion. You can't get it. Just work with innocence to be led by the Lord. And what makes heaven wonderful is it lasts forever. Because you're freed from all this natural mumbo-jumbo garbage. All that external stuff is washed away. And you genuinely can love the Lord and be led in innocence. Think how wonderful that is. Filled with joy all the time. In some ways, when I talk about this, the reason why I think I get a little bit choked up is because I'm a very, very natural person. And I recognize that that is not me. And so there is a clash of my old will and my new will. And there's a part of me that does not like talking about that kind of stuff. Angels love it. It's what gets them going. So let's read about 290, because now we need to dispel a few myths about peace. The angel said that rest of mind and tranquility and enjoyment from the removal of cares and success in affairs seem to be constituents of peace. So, pause. It's the tranquility of enjoyment from removal of cares and success in affairs. In other words, it's like after finishing your taxes, mailing them off or clicking send on TurboTax, and getting that little report, yep, we accept your taxes, you're done, we're never going to bother you about it again. And you're like, ah. You might even get a rebate. Ah, cha-ching. That is not peace. They look like the constituents of peace, I'm reading on, but are so only with those who are in heavenly good. In other words, yes, that feeling you get by filing your taxes and not being worried or afraid of the government is peace, if you are in heavenly good. And yeah, I did just equate taxes with temptation and evil, but you know. For only in that good is peace possible. For peace flows in from the Lord into the inmost of such, and from their inmost descends and flows down into the lower faculties, producing a sense of rest in the mind, tranquility of disposition, and joy therefrom. But to those who are in evil, peace is impossible, which means everyone on earth, because they're a little bit in evil. There is an appearance of rest, tranquility, and delight with things when things succeed according to their wishes, but it is external peace and not at all internal. For inwardly they burn with enmity, hatred, revenge, cruelty, and many evil lusts, into which their disposition is carried away whenever anyone is seen to be unfavorable to them, and which burst forth when they are not restrained by fear. Consequently, the delight of such dwells in insanity, while the delight of those who are in good dwells in wisdom. The difference is like that between hell and heaven. So did that help a little bit with why people in Auschwitz can sometimes feel at peace, but then it goes away? That they can be content, but really they're not.
I guess it's the idea that being in certain circumstances and being content with it. My question is, are there circumstances, or haven't there been circumstances in history in different places where it's really impossible to be at peace in any way or even an inkling of it? I mean, you're just so bad at it.
Well, genuinely at peace? No. You know, through all of history, there's never been a time where someone on earth could have genuine peace. Because they have an evil will, let alone all the natural circumstances.
I have a sort of a counterexample where I think somebody evinced a little bit of a sense of peace. And this is an article I read in, I think, the Parade magazine years ago. Mm-hmm. They interviewed a sewer crawler. A sewer crawler is a person who, of small girth, crawls sewers. Apparently they used to do this in the old days. And they interviewed this person, and he had a big family, and everything was good. He didn't complain about his job. I mean, you know, sewer crawling, you've got to be kidding. Everything seemed good, and I thought, wow, this is amazing. And that kind of person was sort of what seemed to be described in the previous number. Happy with his lot, the pay was lousy, he had a lot of kids to feed, who knows where he lived, but anyway, things seemed good. So that's the kind of person, but I just think that that's such an exception, because most people who live in difficult circumstances have a hard time feeling at peace, I would think.
Yes.
Especially if somebody's oppressing them, you know, the Romans or whatever.
Yeah, one of my favorite TV shows is Dirty Jobs, which is where this guy goes around and interviews sewer crawlers. And they're some of the most at-peace people he meets because they love their use. But the heaven and hell and the Lord is making clear everyone on earth cannot have genuine peace because they're still in their natural world. They're still, you know, that could be one of the most regenerate persons in the world. But he is still basically a natural person because here he is. So he's going to have bad days. You know? Well, Matthew.
Just one thought is that the passage.
We're doing Q&A right now. Matthew.
The passage that came to mind with this is the one that we used in the mailing out for Jacob's Creek when we decided on the theme of the life after death, which is, I think, Divine Providence 73. talks about a person can come into heavenly freedom as long as he acknowledges that the delights in this world are nothing compared to the delights that will be in eternal life.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wonder if that applies, that part of the contentment, as you were saying, is to acknowledge that this isn't going to necessarily be great in this world, but I have this hope of looking forward to a day when I will be in that peace and freedom.
Jujhu Love talks about the first fires of the passion of marriage being given to couples so that it can sustain them. But it's also merely an image or a reflection of the true joys of marriage that's only available to angels. We just don't get it. I think about meditation type people who are obsessed with attaining inner peace, and it's almost like it's a drug they need, and they are hunting after it. And there's a fun little passage in the Heavenly Doctrine. I can't remember the number, but it's talking about a special hell for people who are hermits, because they're obsessed with their own peace. So it's not genuine there either. Brad?
Yeah, I've wondered about that, those statements of the doctrines too, Greg. And it, one of the things I was struck in the last year or so where I've been to West Africa and Cuba, these third world nations, and it breaks your heart and all that kind of thing. And I went down there kind of, with this pity in my heart for these poor people, and found that I actually came back with more pity in my own heart for my love. I was just struck that, they are obviously worried about clothing, food, all those natural anxieties, but there seems to be in many of them an inner contentment and peace where when you sit in a room, because they don't have all that external stuff, you immediately start talking about God, family, things that are important. And I just remember being struck that, they probably have more external worries than I do, but they may actually be more at peace and content with their lot than I am, even though I have more. It's an amazing dichotomy.
What time do we go to? 10:20, when we need to stop so you can go do your discussion group. All right. Mike, and then
Dan. There is a good avenue for discretion between being at peace where you are, but nevertheless not being bad because you have ambition to do better. You can do both, but just how does that work?
Mm-hmm. Well, I send my little blurb that we're taught that we are supposed to want to go to heaven. You're supposed to pray for heaven, like to go to heaven. You are supposed to want this. It's okay to be a little bit selfish about wanting peace. Okay? You are allowed to love yourself. Just love the Lord more. But you are also supposed to genuinely want this innocence and peace because it's a way of bringing the Lord joy. You're allowed to aspire to wanting to bring the Lord joy. And you can acknowledge in your own life, I'm trying to bring others in the Lord joy. I'm not very good at it. I want to be better at it. It's sort of a tension. But Gabby?
Two thoughts. One is that one of the reasons that we don't experience peace on earth is that we're still here fighting the fight. And as long as we're fighting the fight, we have the opportunity to continue to make ourselves better through that fight. Mm-hmm. And so it's, in one sense, because that lack of peace is because you're still working and good work. The other thought is that another form of lack of peace is when you see a wrong that needs to be righted, and you are fighting for what's good, and it's not peaceful to see, for example, other people in suppression, and you're going to fight to help them out of that. That's not a peaceful place. But underneath it is a sense of peace because you know you're doing the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of a contradiction. That peace feels, I don't know, is that zeal?
Well, it's like the angels who have to go down and police the hells. and carry with them a sphere of heaven with them, and nothing can harm them. And they're dealing with people who they have compassion for, who hate them. That's got to be hard. But it's not hard for them. Because they're doing the Lord's work, and they're totally in innocence. It's an amazing thought. Fred.
We have the principle that we should be content with the dispensations of God's providence, and that's a beautiful thought. On the other hand, there are times when our reasonable rights are being overridden. Somebody's just making too much noise when we all should have retired. A whole dozen kinds of things. But we need to, at times we need to be not aggressive and revengeful, but we need to be assertive. We need to, you know, we need to hold up for what's right and proper, mm-hmm. defend our own rights, that sort mm-hmm. of thing. So that in this life, that's something that's very real, and it's always in contrast with our effort to be content with the dispensations of God's providence. Mm-hmm.
And you'll note that this chapter, none of the numbers I pulled out, but there are no other numbers that say that peace is the absence of conflict. Peace does have the absence of conflict, but that's not a definition. The reason why peace doesn't have conflict is because those at peace are willingly led by the Lord. But that doesn't mean that other people aren't in conflict with them. In fact, there will be other people in conflict with them. Yeah, Matthew.
One question for you. Just strikes me that you're talking about us not being able to experience peace, but I wonder if
genuine peace.
Genuine.
We can a reflection of it, but not genuine.
But I wonder how the angelic peace we feel through the angels with us ties into this.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my mind has suddenly went to the fact that when we read the Word, for example, some of the joy and peace we're experiencing isn't our own. It's the peace of the angels that are with us and feeling the delight in our reading of the Word.
That makes me think about how all of our thoughts are because of the way our affections are being stirred by good spirits, evil spirits, angels, and that. But we could get into that. That's a long, good conversation. I'll take one more, but then I need to talk about the discussion stuff. Yeah.
Well, I just wondered about how waking up every morning with the Lord's joy, feeling the Lord's joy, what happens with, it says that the angels are experiencing,
evening states?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think people just get tired. I think that's okay.
And so then they can rest?
Yeah. And people need to take care of themselves and be a little bit selfish in some ways. Angels are never perfect. That's okay. But, and so they sleep. They rest. It's an interesting thought. So, page 2. If you look at it, the angelic life on earth is not easy. So, obviously, I don't have enough time to read all this or give it as a presentation. Ah, but that was not the intention. So, if you'll notice, I have spaced it out. And obviously, you don't have paper or pens with you necessarily. But there are big spaces underneath them. This is Matthew chapter 10. This is what's sometimes called the Apostles' Charge. The reason why it's called the Apostles' Charge is it's the charge that the Lord gave his disciples when he sent them out. All right? In many ways, this is the Lord's charge to you. Go try to be an angel. Now, obviously, we should work on repentance. We should work on focusing on what evils we should shun in ourselves, and then how we can be better people. And we should be doing our use. But in that life of repentance and use, it's going to be a struggle. And imagine just for a moment that for now, you're doing a pretty good job of trying to be angelic. You're going to try and carry this peace with you into your life, this innocence and peace. You genuinely are going to. You're going to go to Holy Supper tonight, and that's going to be your prayer. You know, I would love to be more angelic. Help me be an angel. On earth, you're never really an angel, because you're stuck here. But you can be an apostle. Someone sent by the Lord to bring this sphere of innocence and peace to others, to bring joy from the Lord to others through his truth, through the way you live your life, your youth, things like that. In his charge, which are broken up into different sections, there are specific struggles that the apostles will run into. It's not all, you know, sunsets and roses. His charge is mostly a warning. Go and do these wonderful things, and here's all the trouble you're going to run into. So what I suggest for discussion, when you break into your small groups in about 30 seconds, is you can read these. You can have one person read them out loud and then discuss briefly. So how does this apply to our lives? How can we be more like angels, and how do we struggle with these situations in our lives? Now, yes, it's going to take a little bit of conjecture or theorizing or dragging back from your old memory what some certain correspondences represent, but you can do it. You can do it. This is a way of going directly to the scripture of the word in the New Testament and trying to be guided by the Lord in his word. How can I be more like an angel here on earth? Because heaven is for angels. But being an apostle is for the earth. And you can be an apostle now. You can do it. All right? So we're going to break into small groups now. Thank you very much.
No, we're going to
have snacks. Oh, snacks? And then small groups.